He did 12 sets of isolated or single isometric contractions, either at 30 or 60 degrees knee angle in between these isokinetic sets. So we did first 8 isokinetic contractions, then 1 isometric contractions, and repeated everything all over again 4 times. And after each set, we had 5 minutes interval for rest, and every set was made 3 times, making a total of 12 sets. And we had 5 minutes interval between the second and the third. The first and second, and the second and the third. As mentioned yesterday, polio subjects are fantastic people, determination. All these 12 patients, they did the training for 6 weeks, 3 sessions per week. They came Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and not a single one of the patients missed not a single one of the training days. So all did the training in 6 weeks, which I think of as fantastic. The results are seen here. You see from the left, you see the strength of the muscles from the beginning before training, and the middle section you see the strength in those angles and angular velocities where the patients made significant statistically significant increase in strength. And as you see, in we measured 60, 180, 300, and even 30 degrees per second of isokinetic exercise with those angular velocities, and we had increases in all these, although we didn't train other than 180 degrees per second. We trained 30 and 60 degrees isometric. We did not get a significant improvement at 30 degrees, but only 60. So of the trained items, we had increased significantly in all the isokinetic measurements and in the 60 degrees of isometric or static force. All the subject, the 12 subjects, were interviewed and tested 12 months after training. And as you see, they still have increase in strength, and that increase is not significantly reduced in any of these items here. This result is similar to other results made by similar training programs, which have been well documented in both patients and healthy individuals, for instance, in athletes after knee surgery. It's about 10 to 15% increase in the 6 week time. The enzymatic analysis revealed that the oxidative enzyme citrate synthase, and that would answer the question of before, increased, although the trouble was getting good samples, so we only have 7 really reliable samples. You might wonder if this is really muscle tissue, but in the glycolytic enzymes, TPDH and LDH, we have normal values from the beginning, so that would make us believe we have real muscle samples. We had no change in the oxidative, in the glycolytic enzymes, and not in the MK either. In the interview, which was made 5 to 12 months after training, I did that this spring, and the first patients were completed the exercise program in June of 85, and the last patients in December of 85. Then there were 5 to 12 months that had passed since they stopped their training. I asked them of their feeling of strength during or after the training period. 10 out of the 12 subjects, they said they had felt stronger, and 7 of the 10 told me they still felt stronger 5 to 12 months after the training period. The 3 that didn't feel stronger anymore, they told me that they had felt stronger for 1 to 3 months after the training period ended. So the conclusions would be that at least polio patients with the symptoms indicating post-polio syndrome, they can at least at this strength of 3+ in the quadriceps muscle group, they can be trained to increased strength by a program of this kind. The muscle morphology, because of type grouping, was not conclusive. We couldn't use that as means of training result, because as you would understand, the place of sampling becomes more important than the fiber distribution of the muscle when you have cells type grouping. The oxidative enzymatic activity, it was increased, as we said, and the general feeling of well-being and increased strength was persisting 5 to 12 months after the training period in most of the subjects. And I just wanted to mention, even if no results are available, that I had the pleasure of having the possibility of taking 11 of these 12 patients to Uppsala in June and measuring them with Erik Stålberg in his laboratory with SFEMG measurements. And I talked to him on the phone several days ago. I don't know if I should tell you the results. I've been trying to tell David Weekes, and I seem to mix it up. I don't know exactly, but Stålberg told me that it doesn't seem that the patients are unstable. They show classical post-polio changes, like increase in jitter, but they don't see, at least the majority of them don't show any signs of being overloaded by the training. But that's preliminary results. They are not being put together. We hope to come later on. So, ending with this beautiful picture of a birth of a land. I don't know if this is any hope in the future, but time will reveal that. Thank you. I want to thank Laura Holstead and the organizers for inviting us here. Been very pleasure. It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Jubel, Northwestern. I just want to ask a question. My impression from reading the literature, like Dr. Herbison studies, and maybe Dr. Joey will want to comment a little bit, and from the patients I've seen, is that the patients who have very mild weakness, like 4/5 rating type of weakness, and I mentioned some of those yesterday, seem like they may improve in strength with exercise. While with those patients who have fairly severe weakness, or maybe even moderate weakness, 2/3/5, may get worse with exercise. Could you divide your patients, say the ones who you rated at 3/5 versus the ones you rated at 4/5, and any idea how that would fall out in terms of the exercise program?
Well, as I said, the patients were by definition a 3+ on the MRC scale from the beginning. In terms of individuals, 9 out of the 12 are by definition post-polio patients. 3 out of the 12 do not regard themselves as being worse during the last few years. No, we are not able to divide them into groups by that standard, because Well, this of course is only a subgroup of post-polio patients. These are those who are able to walk, at least some. Many of them use the wheelchair for longer transportations, but all of them are able to walk. None of the patients get worse. Actually, Dr. Stolberg told me that one of the patients were showing a little instability, indicating that it might be possible that she is suffering from overload, but she showed instability in both legs, even in the leg not trained. And she, who's a 31-year-old female, which has 29 years history of polio, she's one of the three not indicating that she's getting worse. So I don't know how to interpret those results, but...
Belvin from Alberta. I've got three questions for you, please. The first one is, can you tell me whether any of the muscles that you strengthened demonstrated less than anti-gravity strength?
I beg your pardon, I didn't hear you.
Whether there were any muscles that demonstrated less than anti-gravity in strength?
No, the answer is no.
Okay, the second question is, were you able to differentiate whether the weakness that you were seeing was secondary to disuse in your patients? Was there any way that you could determine that?
We have done muscle biopsies in all of them. And by that means, they are polio muscles, yes.
Okay.
So that was the study criteria, so to speak, mm-hmm. to have muscle biopsies before we included them in the study.
All right, thank you. And the third question is, was there any period of training at all during the 12-month period after your initial training period before you evaluated them again for the third column?
None organized, but most of the patients told me that they were more active than before, and one could maybe conclude that the activities of daily living, which they were able to do in a greater extent than before, would be their training. I don't know if that's the right answer, but there was not any organized training from our side.
Gunnar Grimby, just a comment. This is the same subjects as I showed in my slides. So quite a majority of the subjects in the training study had already large fiber area, meaning they actually have strained their muscles before the training program started.
Joeed from Philadelphia. First of all, I want to commend you for the data that you have presented on the isometric as well as isokinetic due to exercise, because it seems to be almost similar to what Archie Young and White and Davies have shown in their subjects in England, as well as we also have found similar kind of isometric and isokinetic strengths, which is amazing to see considering the fact that polio patients are significantly lowering strength to start with. Secondly, I also like Iceland. It's a very good country. I have been there, and I come.
Thank
everybody
you
should go there. Thirdly, I have a question for you, and that is that as I recall, Dr. Grimby said that he evaluated ADL also in the patients, and did you try to correlate the patient's improvement with the ADL capacity of the patients?
Let me think. No, not in an organized form, no. We have some questionnaires afterwards, but I don't think that's any of those usual ADL questionnaires. It's more of social functioning. So we've sent out questionnaires during this summer to the patients, but it's not the usual type CATS ADL index or things like that.
Did any patients make any comments that it was easier to do certain activities, or there were certain functional activities that they could do now that they couldn't do prior to exercise and training?
Yes, 10 out of the 12.
10 felt that functionally they were improved.
10 patients of the 12, they thought it was easier climbing stairs and things like that, yes. rising from a chair.
Catherine Hoffman, Warm Springs. I would like to make a comment on Dr. Jubelt's comment concerning the inability to strengthen musculature below what we would call here in Warm Springs a fair grade of strength, which is just moving against the resistance of gravity. We, because of the methods we use, being basic muscle reeducation, which is a very specific strengthening type of routine, we have demonstrated in patients with poor grades of strength in musculature that we can bring them back up to a fair or a fair plus grade of strength, thereby improving their function against gravity. Certainly, I think at this point we probably need to put some of that information together. But I think that one of the things that I'm concerned with is that when you put patients on exercise programs against gravity or on self-exercise programs and they have the weakened musculature that is below gravity strength, they're probably substituting stronger musculature to do those exercises so that you're not really getting the strengthening in the muscles that you want.
Well, I don't keep with you. We have taken muscle biopsies from the vastus lateralis before the training and made sure that they were polio muscles, and we've checked them again. So I think really we have made improvement in polio, or the patients, so to speak, have made improvement in polio muscles. But on the other hand, we would have to follow up this study in 2 or 3 years' time to see if, after all, we've implied overload and that it was deleterious.
Fugelmeyer, Sweden, Denmark or somewhere. I have three reasonably short questions to you. First of all, on the training, did you set some actual goal for each training period? For instance, using feedback, as I know that Dr. Grimby has done before and I have done before. Or did they just train as well as they felt without any sort of level? Just keep this in mind. I have two other questions. Looking upon that diagram also, one wonders, they did increase in peak torque. I can clearly see that. And I think you said that they did not, that the strength after 5 months and 12 months was not significantly reduced from the attained value. However, was it significantly better than the value before training? I didn't hear that, at least. And it doesn't look very much like that. Finally, the effect of training, you haven't really not, and you commented on it yourself, you're really not shown that there was any reasonably safe metabolic effect. Couldn't it simply be learning?
The answer to the first question is no, we didn't set up any goals at all. To the second question, the answer is no. I don't think the increase 5 to 12 months after the beginning of training is significant statistically, but the main thing is that they have maintained at least half of the increase from the beginning, which is interesting. Could you give me a clue on
learning? The question on learning, but I don't think you can really answer that now, but it was just pointing out that you are using the same same assessment method as training method. So I don't think you can manage that now if you didn't use Moritani or somebody while you did the things.
You said that Perry, California. You said that 9 of 12 of your patients had symptoms. The customary symptoms are pain, increasing weakness, and fatigue. What was the instance of those three symptoms in your group? How many had pain? How many complained of weakness? How many complained of fatigue?
Well, I'm sorry, I don't have that figures with me. When we started this in 1984, we were not aware of the importance of distinguishing between those symptoms. So we just listed them and we asked the patients to do in one of our questionnaires, all the patients they made a a curve showing the years from the onset of polio until best function was achieved, and then the length of time of best function, and then the deterioration in some or many of the aspects that later became defined as the post-polio syndrome. So we don't have it listed.
Then you don't know if any of them had pain. They may have just had weakness.
Well, I know that all of them have weakness and many of them have pains. I'm sorry, I can't answer it exactly how many of them have pain. But all these patients are weak at least in one leg.
Dr. Hoffman raised the question that how can you be sure that with the type of exercise program you're doing here, that you're not strengthening the other quadriceps muscles, the rectus femoris or the vastus medialis, and Dr. Grimby is going to make a response.
Gunnar Grimby, Göteborg, Sweden. The strengthening training program was for knee extension. Measurement of muscle strength was of knee extension. By all means, all muscles involved in knee extension are activated and trained, and it's the sum results. Vastus lateralis has only interest for the biopsy studies, and the only biopsy studies reported here with respect to the effect of training was increase in the activity of an oxidative enzyme, which was statistically significant in the whole group, and demonstrates that there might be or there could be metabolic adaptation with this type of training program with the repeated sets of contractions. So that's the only type of analysis which is specific for vastus lateralis. All the other, namely the strength measurements, are for the whole knee extension. And concerning learning, we don't know what is further hypertrophy, because that was difficult to evaluate by muscle biopsies or by any other type of measurements. But we all know that in the beginning of a training program, a better recruitment of motor units is an important factor, and I don't know if you should call it learning directly. And I would guess that that happened also in these subjects who already had upped the size of muscle fibers to quite a large extent. And we can note here that we get changes also in other speeds and situations than those trained, which is of interest.
I would like to add a little here. We made measurements both before and after the training period in all both isometric angles and isokinetic velocities in flexion strength, and we did not get any, we did not train any flexion at all. We did not get any significant increase in flexion at all in any of the angular speeds or the angles of isometric measurements.
Peter Gower, Auckland. The question about significance has been answered, but I have a comment and a lateral thought to throw into the arena. The comment is to congratulate you on the specificity of the exercise, and I think that'll go a long way towards solving the argument as to whether exercise is good or bad for the post-polio syndrome. You have to define the exercise just as tightly as you define the criteria for the post-polio syndrome. The thought is that what you've done by improving the oxidative enzymes, they have in fact have reduced the overloading by improving the aerobic reserve with the potential to delay the onset of blood lactic acid. And there's an interesting paper in the literature from McClure and Pitts where they infused lactic acid into patients with anxiety, and they were able to reproduce all the symptoms of the post-viral syndrome and those of the post-polio syndrome, the non-specific ones of fatigue and lethargy and malaise and pain and headache, and I don't recall whether irritable bowel was included. But it reproduced these symptoms, but if they also infused calcium at the same time, then those symptoms were blocked.
Very interesting.
Halstead, Washington. One of the most frequent questions asked of us who are running post-polio clinics is what about exercise? And I think you've done a nice job of providing us some information on that question. The question I have now for you is for those of us who are going to be going back to polio clinics both here and abroad, and that is, what are the implications for those of us who see patients in a clinic setting who may not have access to Cybex or to the type of training which these folks underwent? What kind of guidelines can we give folks? Is there anything that we've learned from this that can be generalized to patients we're seeing in our home settings?
Well, in review of these results and even Feldman results published last year in orthopedics, I would say that you don't have to have a Cybex. You can easily do it with an Orthotron. And doing some reasonably easy training programs, I don't think that would harm much. But as I said, we couldn't be sure of that before we have a follow-up study, and we would like to have a SF-EMG studies done and a follow-up study of that too. So to be sure, we have to do that, I think.
Dave Weekers, Ohio. This looks very good. It looks like we can improve our strength on our patients with these exercise techniques. My concern is, have we just cost this person two additional years of ambulation by hyper-functioning their residual motor neurons to gain this strength? In other words, what is the cost-benefit ratio of improving this strength? Will it have a negative effect 5 years from now or 6 years from now? Are we burning them out at a faster rate?
Yes, that was part of my comment too. This is a model. It demonstrates an adaptability for a certain group of polio patients to increase strength and probably also some metabolic factors in the muscle. Also, they already strain their muscles to quite a large extent. And then they continue to use their muscles and can hopefully maintain what they achieved. I think then, to put this into the clinical situation, it should be a much more broader training program involving both strength and endurance training to demonstrate that short-term effect, and that's what we are going to do. Its long-term effect is very important to look critical at, and it will take years before we know who should train and who should not train.
Joeed from Philadelphia. We have done some studies in normal subjects, training them just 1 to 3 maximum isometric contractions, and we have been able to increase the muscle strength of normal subjects up to 20 to 30% of their original strength within 3 to 4 weeks after the exercise. It might have some involvement of the training or learning itself. However, we believe that it's possible, and in fact, Mueller's work and other works in 1970 have suggested that you don't need to have a great deal of exercise to increase isometric muscle strength.
Munsat, Boston. Do you believe that it's possible that part of the neuromuscular post-polio syndrome that we've been talking about, the problem actually resides in the muscle fiber, and that in some way you could alter the rate of deterioration by an exercise program? I keep thinking of what those curves that Patton showed and DeLocker showed would look like if at some point you introduced an exercise program. Do you think that curve would be altered, or possibly could you level it out?
Well, I'm sorry, I wouldn't know that. The only thought I've had is that you might use the capacity still being in the muscle, might use it more effectively. But as to your question, I wouldn't know it. No.
Feldman, Edmonton, Alberta. Dave Weekers, in response to your question regarding burning out of motor units, I should think that the answer might very well be as in the realm of fatigue. If you fatigue these muscles, you burn them out. If you don't fatigue them, but you can exercise them, they may last much longer than you think.
We have one more.
Laura Smith. I think it's
unwise to equate strength with a Cybex performance. Cybex is a motor technique that can be improved. And if you test people once a week for 3 weeks or even once a week for 6 weeks, you can get this kind of improvement. 20% is not a lot of increase in a Cybex performance. You take normal people and test them perhaps once a week for 3 weeks or even 6 weeks, you can get 50% increases. So a great deal of this type of performance has to do with learning.
Catherine Hoffman again of Warm Springs. I have the same concerns that David Weekers mentioned when he was questioning you about the possibilities of maybe several years from now with this type of training having a wearing out effect and what we would call here in Warm Springs an overwork effect on these type of muscles, because we know people who come back with histories of having been on a strong strengthening program who strengthened significantly for a period of time, and then within the year sometimes they have completely lost function in those muscle groups. I would like to suggest that you add to your database the patient's very specific functional activities, maybe similar to some of the items that I was mentioning yesterday, so that you would have those comparisons before they started your program, during your program, and at various intervals then in the years, as well as possibly someone who could do specific manual muscle testing in the extremities that you're exercising. I know there's a great deal of controversy about specific manual muscle testing, but if you have an excellent tester who's doing your test consistently, you might get some different types of information.
Well, I agree with you on the first part. To comment on the previous comment and the last part of your comment is, it's very hard to do reproducible studies, and I don't think you can do that with the MRC scale. You can do that with one examiner, but you can't when applying it on muscle strength above 3+, it's different. Anyhow you do it. So by applying, the best method we could find to do this was to applying a computerized program to the Cybex, which compensated for the weight of the lower leg and the lever arm. So I don't know of any better method of reproducibility.
Okay, thank you very much. I hope that Dr. Anderson and Dr. Grimby will be able to follow these patients for the next 5 to 10 years to give us a partial answer at least. Okay, for summing up this afternoon's session, we have another senior neuromuscular statesman. A senior's better than elder, I think, and Dr. Walter Bradley.
Thank you. Dr. Einerson's patient's muscles may not be subject to overload, but I suspect that we are at the end of today. We've had an awful lot of data, and trying to sum this up is extremely difficult. I want really just to approach three questions that I think we might have asked at the beginning of the day and see where we've got to by the end of the day. The first is, what is the basis of each of the symptoms that patients with post-polio syndromes are complaining about? The second is, what is the difference between patients who had polio but have no complaints and those who have now progressive complaints? And the third is, what is going on? What's the basis of those complaints which are progressing in these patients? And let's see where we've got to. If you group patients by the symptoms, and we've heard this yesterday and a little today, you can classify fatigue, you can talk about progressive deformities, you can talk about pain, the basis of which may be explicable, for instance a disc prolapse, or may be inexplicable, and you can classify patients into progressive muscle weakness, the PPMA patients. In the fatigue aspect of the symptoms, patients, as they tell their stories, and many of you have heard many more than I've heard, but it seems like the sort of fatigue that people are complaining about who have a collagen vascular disease, an underlying cancer, or aging which they're unprepared to accept. It seems like that non-specific sort of excessive
amount of tiredness that I wouldn't expect to have, but I'm being subjected to it. That's the sort of basis it seems to be. And to date, I don't think we've heard anything that really provides us with an answer to that. With regard to the pain, again, I think we've seen the back kneeing, the increased deformity, the scoliosis, and that sort of process, which I think we all understand as cause of pain. But what do you do with a patient like this? Here's a woman of 35 who, at the age of 5, had a relatively mild attack of fairly typical polio affecting the left leg and back, who now at the age of 35 presents with about a year's history of pain of severe excruciating type in the buttock and left leg area. Plain spinal x-rays are essentially normal. CAT scan shows tremendous atrophy of the paraspinal muscles on the left-hand side, and EMG, myelogram, and all other investigations looking for an underlying etiology are absolutely normal. Here's a woman with the pain that's got to the stage where she's narcotic addicted, and yet we still have no structural or other abnormality that can explain the basis of that pain. And there are pain of in other distributions in many of these patients. That still is an unanswered question. I don't think, again, we've heard anything that really, unfortunately, answers that today. Then, what are the differences between the symptomatic and the asymptomatic patients? We've heard a great deal of information from the electrophysiologists this morning and the muscle pathologists and the people who brought together several of these different disciplines this afternoon. And I think what we've heard is that there aren't any differences to date between the symptomatic and the asymptomatic individuals. And I think that that's a very important potential bottom line conclusion. It may well be, and I propose this as a null hypothesis that we should be trying to knock down in the end, it may well be that there is, in fact, a progressive, ongoing process which is occurring, maybe neuronal degeneration, maybe spinal cord inflammation, we'll come back to that in a minute, which is occurring in all patients at a certain duration after the acute attack of polio. And in all of them, that is the basis of their complaints, or that will eventually be the basis of their complaints if they're going to develop them. That null hypothesis is, I think, what we should be trying to do, and trying to separate what is different between those who have and those who don't have progressive symptoms. And then what is going on, the third question, what is going on as a basis of those with symptoms, and particularly those with symptoms of progressive muscle weakness? Well, I think we could have assumed that, or we could have hypothesized that there would be abnormalities, perhaps of the skeletal muscle, degeneration of the muscle, that might be, perhaps of the spinal cord, some progressive changes which are occurring in the spinal cord. There could have been progressive dysfunction of the motor nerve terminals in the muscle. There could have been progressive degeneration of the nerve terminals in the muscle. Or there could be progressive degeneration of the whole of the motor neuron. And all of those are possible. Now, what have we heard? I think the electrophysiologists have told us fairly clearly that they've seen no evidence really of the changes of myopathy. The changes that I won't define, but they've certainly not been talking to us about myopathy. They have told us about instability of motor units, subunit dropout intermittently blocking, jitter increasing, which seems to be the same in both the asymptomatic and the symptomatic patients, and fibrillations, which also seem to be present in both the asymptomatic and the symptomatic patients. I think physiological techniques don't allow us to ask the question easily, is there whole motor neuron death? The techniques can't do that, unfortunately, and we've got to turn to muscle biopsy to let us see that. And to some extent, the change in the muscle biopsy, there is some dispute, I think we've seen. Some inflammation, Dr. Dulakis has emphasized, Dan Drachman described earlier, quite a significant amount of inflammation in some patients. Is that the basis of the progressive weakness? My judgment, and I think probably many people's judgment, would be no, there isn't enough of it. There are quite a lot of secondary myopathic changes that we've seen illustrated here, muscle fiber splitting, moth-eaten fibers, and necrotic fibers occasionally, and so forth. And I could add to that for cases that we've seen with granulovacuolar degeneration, cores, and tubular aggregates in some individual patients. But again, my judgment would be that that is not enough to explain the progressive muscle weakness that these patients are having. And so we really come back to what then is going on in the nerve or in the spinal cord. And really, Dr. Pez's studies are very exciting, and I think we look forward to more of these. And this is, I think, what we should come to a conclusion about between ourselves. What we really need to do is collect a lot more pathological cases of patients with post-polio syndrome coming to autopsy and try to see whether we could centralize this information, maybe send down the blocks and so forth to Dr. Pez for really bringing all this information together. Chromatolysis was interesting in your study. I'd refer back to Bernard Tomlinson's studies of the patients who'd had amputations. 20 years ago, patients who had amputations, when they die, still have ongoing chromatolysis in their anterior horn cells. So the anterior horn cells can still be trying to repair, still be trying peripherally to grow, even this number of years after some insult of that nature. What is going on in the anterior horn cell and its peripheral nerve terminals? What does wearing out really mean? What is the answer for this question with regard to, is exercise going to give us a short-term benefit, but unfortunately take away the long-term prognosis of those patients? I don't think we've got an answer. I'm going to try and approach that tomorrow in the last presentation of the whole of this conference, but I think the bottom line is what we can say is that there is hypothesis, but there is really no answer as yet. And I think with that we will adjourn, sir. Thank you.
This is the end of Take 10 and concludes this portion of the program.